The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Fred Brack from the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten, as it always is, by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. Want to talk to them about insurance? They are not just nationwide, as they used to be featured. They include Travelers and Progressive and other people. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. You know, last week we ran over reading the pictorial, which we almost never do, because there was a little lead-in article called Island Time talking about the annual coastal issue here in the June 2019 issue of Our State magazine. So I'm going to pick up where I left off, finish the pictorial for you, and then read one of the main articles. This is a beautiful picture of a porch with a tree with some very soft-looking branches that are, I guess it's some kind of an evergreen tree. I'm not really sure. I've never seen one like it. It's kind of hanging over the entrance to the porch, and there's a big Adirondack-type chair which has an ottoman which slopes down. So when you get into that, you just really just lay back and don't want to get up. Cruise in. Little pun there, C-R-E-W-S, in, I-N-N. Alton balanced nose Ocracoke inside and out. Like many natives, he can trace his family's island roots back to the 1700s. He even wrote the book on the area's history and culture, Ocracokers, published in 1989. For three decades, he's owned and operated Cruise Inn Bed and Breakfast next door to his childhood home. Over the years, a few things have changed. Last summer, Balance transformed the former innkeeper's cottage into a light, bright, and airy retreat. And for most part, however, the simple pleasures of this 1908 home are much the same as they were a century ago. Bed sheets, lined dried in the sunshine, a cozy sitting room for coffee and conversation, and a wraparound porch to enjoy the island breeze. For many, the flying melon is a summer tradition. They return to Ocracoke eager to find the dishes they've been dreaming about all year. It's a picture of probably the owners up at the top, and a delicious-looking meal of some fresh fish, and they've got some greens on top and something else. I don't know what it is, and it looks like carrot strips and maybe a little red pepper in the background and a curlicue of lemon. The Flying Melon Cafe, the Schrammel family, has perfected the art of island fine dining. Chef Michael elevates fresh seafood and home-grown produce. His wife, Paula, runs the front of the house, and their son, Nat, a teenager when they opened in 2004, is now a certified sommelier and head of the bar program. When the restaurant moved into a new building in 2013, the family wove together new touches of Michael's native New Orleans. The bar top, a slab of century-old sinker cypress, was pulled from Louisiana waters with elements of coastal North Carolina, like a tower inspired by local life-saving stations. The two locales are linked on the plate, too. Dishes like red drum topped with sautéed crab meat and lemon beurre blanc, that's the picture I was describing, which answers the question of what was on top, which combine the day's catch with food traditions like from Michael's youth, making up the menu's heart. There's a picture of the building here. It is vertical wood siding, wood that's put together with, I find it a little hard to, if I said it was just wooden siding, that wouldn't be a good description of it. It's a very attractive vertical type wood on the wall. A bright sign that says the Flying Melon, good food, open, and there's some people hanging around the front porch, and a bike rack that is quite full out front. A taste of Ocracoke. For a fragile fruit figs fare surprisingly well in Ocracoke's sandy soil. Local fig expert Chester Lynn has counted 14 varieties on the island. Fig trees have grown here almost as long as there have been permanent residents, having likely arrived on the North Carolina coast with 18th century settlers. But for all their abundance, they're best during a short summer window. And they don't keep long, so many cooks dry, can, or bake them into a cake. Most okra cookers credit the late Margaret Garish with the creation of the island's signature dessert. Apparently, while baking a date cake sometime in the 1960s, she used preserved figs that she had on hand instead. And the Ocracoke Fig Cake was born. Every August at the Ocracoke Fig Festival, bakers pay tribute to Garish's invention with a competition based on her recipe. What started as a simple improvisation in a home cook's kitchen has endured as a symbol of islanders' independence and ingenuity. What I'm looking at kind of resembles a brownie, but it's like rolls up on one end and then gets flat, except it's all brown and has little pieces of nut in it. So that must be a fig brownie. And there's an open fig right beside. You got to watch out for all of those seeds inside. But that brownie looks, looks absolutely delicious. And then there's some of the green figs growing on a tree here. Island crafted, roads and ferries and the arrival of thousands of tourists each summer mean that Ocracoke is not as isolated as it once was. But traces of the past live on in longtime residents. In the Ocracoke brogue that famously makes high tide sound like hoitoid. And in the traditions passed down through generations, Clifton Garish and his sister Janie are native Ocracokers who cherish their family's history on the island. Like their grandfather, Clifton worked as a carpenter. Like their late brother Raymond, his passion is wood carving. A display case in the Garish's living room holds duck decoys and other figurines, some made by Clifton, some by Raymond, and some that they worked on together. I like traditions, Janie says, because traditions bring back good memories. This is a lovely decoy. The duck has its head turned around back, and its beak is just touching the center of its back. And the piece of wood that's used is such that all of the rings of the wood focus right on the side of the duck where the wing might be. So you see the circles going out from that area. Just beautiful. And there's an inset of the man, Clifton, who is working on sanding one of the bodies of the decoys before it gets stained. Sand and stars. Visitors to Ocracoke drive off the ferry and into what feels like a different world. It's easy to lose track of the time and even the days on what feels like the edge of the earth. One thing for sure, when the sun goes down, the island is enveloped in thick, velvety darkness. The lack of light pollution means that clear nights are especially starry, especially on Lifeguard Beach, where an evening stroll along the crashing surf may offer a view of the Milky Way, as we see here. There is a young lady sitting on the edge of a lifeguard stand in profile. The stand and the lady are all black here because of the way the picture is taken against the light, somewhat light evening sky with its tens of thousands of stars shining through, and then a whole bunch up, which looks like a big cloud, being the Milky Way. The people who come here to the edge of North Carolina are adventurous. They seek a little wildness. On Ocracoke, they find it. And thus ends our pictorial that I hope I have adequately interpreted for you. And you are listening to Our State Magazine on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. If you have any comments on our program, please call the studios at 919-832-5138. And now, Cape Lookout, Keepers of the Light. There are no bridges on Cape Lookout, no roads along the 56 miles of islands. In the 7 years that Ron and Joan Preloger have come here to watch over its iconic lighthouse, they've survived raging storms and swarms of stink bugs. They wouldn't have it any other way. Written by Lane de Gregory. We see partial pictures of them here. They are in white rockers, and they're holding hands. And here's a picture of the Ocracoke, or rather the Cape Lookout light. Now, you know, in North Carolina, they do different things, like the one on Ocracoke is just solid white, and up in Currituck, it's a clay color. And this one is triangles put together, black and white. You know, they rotate around. So we're looking at the side, and we see a big patch of black, and then we see a patch of white, and then a couple of just two windows going up the side to the top, and then the keeper's house some distance away with a pathway between the two. After the last ferry leaves the dock, carrying away all of the day trippers, the island is theirs again. Ron and Joan Preloger wave to the departing boat, then wind along the wooden boardwalk through an ocean of sea oats toward the lighthouse they call home, at least for a few weeks each year. "I'll bet that storm washed up a slew of shells," Ron tells his wife at about 5 p.m. on this evening in early autumn. "Let's ride out to the beach before it gets too dark." Their grown children worry about them all the way out here at Cape Lookout National Seashore. Just the two of them, retired teachers, both 70 years old. A 30-mile drive from Beaufort, plus a 15-minute ferry ride from Harker's Island. There's no internet access, only spotty cell service, and a landline they use to talk to park service colleagues. Their friends from church can't understand why they travel 2 days from Indiana to the eastern edge of the continent to stay on a sliver of sand between Back Sound and the Atlantic Ocean, to cut grass, sweep floors, and clean public toilets, without a car, without air conditioning, without pay. The Prelogers can't explain it either. They talk about the isolation, being far from news and noise. They describe the roar of the waves bashing on the beach, the whistle of sand, or rather the whistle of wind, sculpting the loons haunting lullaby. They talk about the silver sheen of salt water, wild horses splashing through the surf, stars piercing the inky sky, the smell of the sea, the briny taste of the air. Unless you come to the Barrier Island, unless you spend the night with the Prelogers so far from civilization, you can't truly understand their desire to retreat to one of the country's last outposts of unspoiled seashore. Some of our friends are cruise people. They want everything to be planned and taken care of, to live this fantasy surrounded by thousands of strangers and never leave the ship, Jones says. We've discovered we don't need much to be happy. In the 7 years they've been taking care of the keeper's quarters beside the diamond-patterned lighthouse, the Prelogers have survived raging storms, fierce flooding, attacks from green flies, swarms of stink bugs, raccoons stealing food off the grill, generators dying, even the haunting portrait of an old lighthouse keeper whose eyes seem to follow them. You get used to it, Joan says. At least you try. Out here, they never know what to expect. Ron picks up Joan in an off-road four-wheeler at 6 p.m. in front of the two-story house, with 9 shuttered windows and a chimney sprouting from each end. The porch rails are covered in shells. The couple collects them to send home with visitors and to take back to their 3 grandkids. Ron likes Scotch bonnets, striped or checkered. Joan prefers conches, which she presses against her ear to hear the sea. When we first started coming out here, we couldn't believe how many shells there were and how perfect they were, Joan says, climbing onto the Polaris ATV. With this, we can drive farther up the beach than most people will walk. So we collect as many big ones as we can. There are no bridges to Cape Lookout. no official roads along the 56 miles of islands. Car ferries carry only a few four-wheel drive trucks from the towns of Atlantic and Davis. Some private boats come from Beaufort, Atlantic, and Harker's Island. But most visitors pay $17 for the passenger ferry, which carries as many as 50 folks at a time. Summer weekends are busiest, with 2,000 visitors a day coming to swim, sunbathe, surf, fish, and explore. The park is free, open all year. There are no hotels or restaurants, just rustic cabins to rent, or you can tent camp on the beach. From mid-May through mid-September, you can climb the lighthouse's 207 iron steps and look out over the ocean. When you're up there, you can't help but think of all the ships that light guided, Ron says, all the sailors that it has saved. On their hunt for shells, Ron drives north for a while, weaving behind dunes, then turns east and parks on a slick swath of sand. Joan gets out, clutching plastic bags. Stretching along the shore, as far as she can see, are piles of huge whole oysters and angel wings, knobbed whelks and bay scallops, horseshoe crabs, sand dollars, and starfish, all washed up in the storm. Joan fills her bags, loads them into the four-wheeler, and then fills two more. "We should head out soon," Ron says. "I still want to stop by the village." Neither Joan nor Ron grew up near the coast. They don't sail or boat, didn't come from seafaring families. Their love of the lighthouse, they say, grew from their love for each other, a drive to help preserve the past and to escape. It's amazing getting to stay so far from any development in an environment that's still in its natural state, Joan says. We've learned to depend on just each other a lot more. They look like each other now. Same cropped gray hair, square glasses, warm smiles. They dress alike, polos embroidered with a park emblem. They finish each other's sentences, respect each other's silences. They met in choir at Concordia University in Chicago more than 50 years ago. Got married after graduation, had a son, then a daughter. Joan taught third grade. Ron taught middle school music. During summers, they drove their kids to the beach, went fishing. For their 25th anniversary, they boarded a mail boat to a small island off of Maine in Acadia National Park and stayed in a two-story lighthouse without electricity. All night, they lay awake listening to lobster boats bouncing against the piers, feeling for the first time that they were alone. I guess that's when we got hooked. Ron says. They became interested in lighthouse history, stories of men who tendered the remote towers, who caught rainwater in cisterns and carried 45 pounds of oil up 12 stories twice a day to keep the lights burning. Their job required hardiness, skill with mechanical devices, tolerance for boredom and loneliness, he says. Often they didn't bring their families, so it was just them against the elements. Joan became obsessed with the icon, the structure itself. Lighthouse pillows, bedspreads, ornaments, sweatshirts, and earrings. Lighthouse paintings, plates, and fan poles. At their Indiana house, a 6-foot lighthouse stands sentry over their patio. "All my students knew I loved lighthouses," she says. "I must have more than 250 of them at home." Their kids were in college when the couple learned about the Volunteer in Parks program at Cape Lookout. The brick lighthouse was built in 1812, the fourth in North Carolina, and rebuilt in 1859. The beam was powered by whale oil, kerosene, and then electricity. The last full-time keeper left in 1950 when the beacon became automated. Cape Lookout National Seashore began its VIP program a few decades ago when 50 visitors a day was considered high traffic. But after the tower reopened for climbing in 2010, so many visitors flocked to the seashore that the keeper's quarters, docents, Ron and Joan's official title, got to really prove their mettle. For four-week shifts, two people can live in the keeper's quarters for free. They get to use the upstairs, two bedrooms, a square living room, and a cramped kitchen and bath, and drive the off-road Polaris through the park. They have to bring their own linens, pots, pans, and food, greet visitors, clean the museum on the first floor, clear brush, pick up trash, and rescue birds and sea turtles, and most important, sit in the wooden rockers on the front porch answering questions. This is our volunteer time and our vacation, Jones says. As salmon-colored streaks paint the sky, they drive south along the soft sand, rimming the ocean. A few fishermen, leaning on their poles, look up to wave. A flock of shorebirds flit away. The Prologers ride for about 10 minutes, then come upon an abandoned cottage and what once was a mansion now sliding into the salt water. Up until the 1930s, the adjacent island of Shackleford Banks was still attached to Cape Lookout, and there was a little town there that locals called Diamond City, after the lighthouse's black and white pattern. Men fished and caught whales, women tended gardens. Most of the locals moved away from Diamond City after a hurricane in 1899, some of them relocating to the site that became known as Cape Lookout Village. By the 1950s, all of the buildings in the village were summer homes and fishing shacks. But when the government created Cape Lookout National Seashore in 1966, no one lived on the island anymore. The Coast Guard still kept the complex there, and the old life-saving station still stood. But most of the homes had been abandoned. Only 13 original structures remain today, and most are too run down to inhabit, except for the lighthouse and the temporary VIP homes, such as the Keeper's Quarters, which the National Park Service recently refitted with new windows and shutters. We manage the buildings, but the Coast Guard owns the light, says Ranger B.V. Horvat, who helps oversee the island. By May 2017, he says, the Coast Guard had replaced the old beacon with LED clusters and installed solar panels between the pines to power them. The new beam reaches about 14 miles to sea, 10 fewer than the old light. It isn't nearly as bright. So now, instead of walking the beach at night, the Prologers have to get home by dark. When they return to the Keeper's Quarter, the sun is slipping into the sound. They retreat to the back porch and watch sooty clouds blanket the last faint sunbeams. All around them in the marsh, cicadas whir. "Are you getting hungry?" Joan asks. "Let's open the wine." They climb the stairs to the kitchen and sip Zinfandel while they make spaghetti. Ron is at the stove when the first moth falls into his red sauce. He spoons it out and goes back to stirring. Another moth crashes to the counter. Soon dozens are circling the bulb above his head. Joan laughs, and then she too is besieged. Moths in the pasta, moths in the salad, moths in the sink. They can't tell where they're coming from. They never endured a deluge of moths. It's always something, Joan says. They check the window for leaks. Nothing. Joan turns out the kitchen light so it won't attract more moths, but the lighthouse beam keeps blinking through the window, and mounds of papery wings keep fluttering down from the ceiling like confetti. Sometimes, after washing dishes, they are so tired that they go straight to bed. Some nights they sink into worn armchairs in the sitting room and read James Patterson novels or watch MASH on DVD. Each visit they bring the same movie, Castaway, where the Tom Hanks character gets stranded alone on an island. Sometimes they recount their adventures. Remember the time the Boy Scout troop traipsed in at night, wanting to use the bathroom? And the desperate camper climbed through a first-floor window seeking shelter from a storm? How about when those Coast Guard pilots flew their helicopter in close to the lighthouse just to check in and say hi? And that man who dropped to one knee beneath the tower to propose? And that coin that washed up on the beach? A 1730 doubloon. Remember when we helped all those boaters? Joan asked. We must have had 50 people in the museum down there trying to keep warm until the wind died. Yeah, I'm no skilled mariner, Ron says, but I can open the door for you. These modern lighthouse keepers always have cookies and coffee for guests and cell phone chargers to share. Their bedrooms is in the back of the keeper's quarters, overlooking the sound away from the lighthouse. The beacon still winks above them, but below the sky night is black. They go to sleep with the windows open, no shades or curtains, no neighbors who can see in. About 2 a.m., Joan calls Ron out of bed. "Come see this," she says. "What's going on?" Out in the inlet, bright circles of light are dancing on the water. "They look like UFOs," Joan says. "We're not alone." Ron smiles. "Those are probably flounder fishermen," he says, "gigging on the flats. Just another harmless invasion. Another story to bring back to Indiana." Lane DeGregory won the Pulitzer Prize for feature writing in 2009 as a reporter for the Tampa Bay Times. Well, we've got just a minute or so left, so let's see if we can find a short article to read. This one is under the title, "We Live Here, Gathering Place, Corolla, Brews Two Ways, Coffee Shop by Day, Beer Garden by Night." For beachgoers in the northern Outer Banks, the Shack is an all-day affair. After a day of sun and sand on Corolla's pristine beaches, thirsty swimmers and sunbathers retreat to the shade of the large live oak that anchors the beer garden at the Shack. Co-owner and Outer Banks native Matt Soriente built this whole place around that tree. The sleek wooden bar where customers and seats made from metal canisters order beer and wine. The teak root tables and chairs where families chat over chips and salsa and sodas, the wooden archway inviting visitors, canine companions included, onto the spacious patio. In the afternoon and the evening, friends drop in for cold beer and good company, drawn by the sounds of laughter and live music. Some just chat with Matt and his partner, Kelly Rodriguez, also a North Carolina native, for hours. By morning, the Shack is a coffee house. "My little domain," Kelly says. In the small house overlooking the beer garden, baristas whip up locally roasted coffee, smoothies and fraps, and serve pastries and locally baked lighthouse bagels. While customers wait, they examine the canvas prints of the Outer Banks in the 1950s and 60s that hang on the wood-painted walls. Kelly and her family vacationed in this very spot when she was 4, long before she and Matt opened the Shack in 2010. Since then, they've transformed the former home into a favorite hangout for locals and vacationers, who sometimes visit twice a day for the two distinct experiences, cozy coffee shop above, shaded beer garden below. These two places are at 1148 Ocean Trail in Corolla, North Carolina. That's way up there on the Outer Banks. You can find them on the World Wide Web. And believe it or not, they have two different web addresses, CorollaCoffee.com and CorollaBeerGarden.com. Well, my friends, that is about all the time we have for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you will be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State was underwritten, as it always is, by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. Want to call them, say thank you, or talk a little insurance? You can reach them at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Do you have any comments or questions? Well, please call us at the studios, 919-832-5138. Leave a message. Tell us what you're thinking. So long. Until next time. Thank you.